Welcome to Lessons I've Learned, a series of podcasts by global consultant, best-selling author, and former Harvard Business School professor, David Maister.
Hello, I'm David Maister. This series of 15 podcasts is called Managing Professionals: Attitudes, Skills, and Behaviors. It's designed to help people who have the responsibility for managing a group of professionals. This sixth episode is called The Management Strain, and is based on my book, Managing the Professional Service Firm, and my book, First Among Equals, co-authored with Patrick McKenna. In previous episodes, we've discussed how managers should spend their time and the power of one-on-one coaching. In the last episode, we started on the topic of the characteristics that a manager must have in the eyes of those who must follow him or her. Now we're going to dig deeper into what kind of person you must be to be an effective manager of professionals. Not everyone has what it takes to be an effective manager. The more time I spend with professional service firms, the more I realize how different the required skills are between being an outstanding professional and being an effective manager, and how stressful the manager's role can be. On an average day, the typical professional can concentrate. It can concentrate his or her attentions on one or two major projects, staying focused, and probably ending the day with some visible signs of progress. For the typical manager of professionals, the day is usually broken up into numerous small chunks of amazing diversity. Dealing with a disgruntled client, handling the personal problems of a staff member, analyzing financial reports, interviewing a potential new recruit, approving various administrative arrangements, working on a new business presentation, and a thousand other matters, each of which must, in rapid succession, command the manager's full attention. The ability to change mental gears rapidly is one of the manager's most important talents, as is the ability to continuously evaluate and reshuffle priorities during the day. The manager must also learn to live with a higher level of ambiguity and risk than the typical professional. The typical professional's success or failure, for better or for worse, is mostly in his or her own hands, depending upon what he or she does and their technical skill. The manager must accomplish goals through others, and his or her success is less directly under his or her personal control. The result of the typical professional's work are often clearly visible, and the client feedback is frequently prompt. However, for the manager, the very definition of what success means is less clear, and the feedback on whether it's been achieved is much more circuitous and ill-defined. Rarely can a manager go home knowing that something concrete and substantial was accomplished today. The manager of professionals must also possess a great deal of bounce-back ability. As David Ogilvy put it in his book, Ogilvy on Advertising, the CEO of the professional firm must be a good leader of frightened people and resilient in adversity. Professionals look to their managers for inspiration, enthusiasm, and confidence, and never so much as when things are going tough. Rather than being able to indulge the inevitable emotions that accompany daily triumphs and disasters, the manager, it turns out, must maintain an even keel. One of my friends told me that the hardest and most important lesson that he had to learn when taking over the managerial reins was that he had to operate on the principle of no good days, no bad days. To be successful, the manager or coach must be able to suppress his or her own ego needs, since the very nature of the job is to make other people feel successful and important. The job of the manager is to build a team, not an empire. The best leaders of professionals are quick to give credit to others and to play down their own role in successes, a behavior trait that many superb professionals with high ego needs have to work at to acquire at some personal psychological cost. The coach's job contains other stresses. Since few professionals like to be told what to do, the coach or manager must act through persuasion and cajoling, even where the manager is absolutely clear on what needs to be done. Living with the frustrations of building consensus and resisting the temptation to just act or give orders is a permanent personal struggle. This is particularly true in resisting the temptation to intervene in the professional work of others. Managers must allow professionals to make their own decisions and even their own mistakes in order to develop the skills and capabilities of people and the group. Since the manager's job is to teach, he or she must have patience with those still trying to learn. And that's true at all levels, the very good person trying to learn how to be superb. For many, taking on the manager's role means giving up a significant degree of the personal fulfillment that comes from practicing one's own professional craft. Since there are no surer paths to the decline of a professional group than the absence of honest, constructive criticism and the failure to confront non-performers, the coach must also bear the emotionally hard task of giving and justifying performance feedback, and on occasion, termination notices. Another friend of mine says, "You're not a manager till you've fired someone." Managers must also be responsible for reconciling conflicts, especially on the use of resources. In their management of group resources, they must routinely arbitrate between professionals on who gets which staff member, who chases what lead, who's given what opportunity. This is stressful stuff. Coaching takes time, patience, and ingenuity. It is often frustrating and only occasionally rewarding. The manager must also have the ability to interact with others in such a way that a critique, when it is offered, is accepted as welcome assistance and not resented as interference. The manager must be able to ask people to stretch without making them resentful or defensive. This is, again, not easy. It requires a style that results in the manager being seen as a personal resource to the people, not as a nitpicking supervisor nor as a boss. Good managers create motivation in others by communicating and demonstrating their own enthusiasm. Cynicism and excitement are both infectious at the two extremes. Which of the two the manager communicates is critical. Another crucial element in being an effective manager is that in a professional organization, you must have the ability to earn the trust of others. To trust a leader does not necessarily mean that one always agrees with him or her. Trust is the conviction that the person means what he or she says, that the manager cares, that what is being done is not self-serving or driven by ego, but because he or she, the manager, is truly serving the group's long-term purposes. The people being coached must believe that the coach's motives are pure. The coach is not being authoritarian, but is really trying to help. They must make people believe that they are being asked to change, not to make the coach look good, and not just to benefit the greater glory of the firm, but because the coach has helped them to see what is in it for them. In many firms, regrettably, being pointed to a managerial role is some form of reward. The position goes to the most eminent, or the most senior, or the best business getter amongst the professionals. None of these criteria is appropriate. Manager and leadership should be seen as a role, a responsibility, not a title or a promotion or a reward. This is a very highly specialized role which requires a very specific type of personality. It's a difficult job to be done. Naturally, managers cannot be effective if they cannot earn the professional respect of their colleagues. They must have a history of being able to do what they ask others to do. They must be good professionals. But as in sports, the coach does not have to be the best player in order to coach well. There are few individuals who naturally possess the skills I'm talking about here. There are even fewer who are eager to give up a portion of their practice to accept the responsibilities I've discussed. However, given the desire to learn them, coaching skills can be developed, and there lies the opportunity. What I hope is getting clearer and clearer is that technical competence and knowledge will determine only a small portion of your effectiveness as a group leader. The overwhelming determinant of whether or not you will be effective has to do with your people skills, interpersonal, social, psychological, and emotional. I've asked numerous professionals to tell me about their most trusted mentor, teacher, advisor, or leader. I ask people, what specific characteristics did that person have that made them believe that this was somebody they could put their faith in, somebody they felt comfortable going for advice, and somebody whose influence they accepted? Here's a sampling of some of the responses I've received. One person said, "You know, an important aspect of a great leader for me is how interested that person really is in your life. For example, if you tell this individual about something significant that's going on in your personal life, do they follow up and find out what happened?" Another person said, "Anyone can tell you to cheer up. There's lots of people who will tell you that when things aren't going well. It makes them feel good. But see who really goes out of their way to acknowledge when things are going well with the contribution you made on some important project. The real coach is someone proud of your accomplishments, not jealous of your successes or taking credit for it behind your back." A third person said, "When the chips are down and it's you against them, most people will scramble to protect their own interests. But your trusted advisor, your leader, is that individual who's supportive and has some ideas or a plan to help both of you, not someone who looks to save their own butt." Finally, a fourth person said, "A true coach is someone who's honest and will tell you something you may not want to hear. This requires that rare individual who's willing to have you be upset with them if it will help you." I've stayed on this topic because your effectiveness in being a group leader or coach is more about you, your characteristics, and your attitudes than it is about the person you are coaching. In particular, your success as a leader will turn on whether or not you are received by your people as a trusted advisor, which, by the way, is the title of a book that I wrote. If they view you that way, then you can make a lot of mistakes and still have a big impact. But if they view you as somebody trying to play the role of boss or cop or administrator or technical expert telling them what they're doing, then you're going to fail. In your role as coach, you will need to deal with your colleagues with the same sort of delicacy and forethought in your phraseology that you would do in dealing with your most powerful clients. You must take a deep breath every time you go into a colleague's office and ask yourself, "Why am I here? What am I trying to accomplish?" Here are some other questions you should ask yourself. How many of those that I have responsibility to coach would consider me their trusted advisor? In that book that I wrote with the title, my co-authors and I made a list of the common traits that trusted advisors have. Here, changing the language from dealing with clients to dealing with team members is the list. Trusted advisors, 1, seem to understand us effortlessly and like us. We accept influence from people we think like us. 2, they're consistent. We can depend on how they behave. 3, they always help us see things from a fresh perspective. They don't try to force things on us. They help us think things through. It's our decision. Trusted advisors don't panic or get over emotional. They stay calm. They criticize and correct us gently, lovingly. They are reliably on our side and always seem to have our interests at heart. Now, I need to stress that these are not moral points. I'm trying to report to you that these are the characteristics of the people who have the most influence. As you examine this list, here's a few questions for you to consider. Would you also agree that this is what your team members would appreciate? Would you agree that if you acted this way, they'd be more likely to accept your influence and raise their game? How well does this list describe how you are currently acting in guiding, counseling, encouraging, and supervising others? And here's another question that comes from the list. Do you actually like the people you are coaching? And do they know you like them? And do you think it matters? One of the characteristics listed earlier is indeed that our trusted advisors tend to like us. We've said a trusted advisor is somebody you think is basically on your side. So you really do have to ask, do you really like the people you are counseling, and do they think you like them? If they don't, then your effectiveness as a coach will diminish, no matter how valid is the intellectual rigor of your comments. Can you like everybody? No, you can't. But if you can't find anything that you can relate to or like about that person, then you will not be able to coach that person. There are group leaders I know who've told me that they dislike some of the people they're coaching. They ask themselves, how do I deal with this dumb idiot? And my response is, if you think he's a dumb idiot, there's probably not much impact you can have. Unless you can find something you can empathize with, you will not have an influence on that person. That's a tough message. You can't influence people you despise, because most of us are too transparent. We're just not that good at faking it. Next question. Do the people you are seeking to coach actually view you as somebody who cares about them? Can the skills of a coach or a trusted advisor be learned, or do you have to be born with them? As with most skills in life, my answer follows the 10-80-10 rule. For most skills, 10% of people are naturals. You don't need to teach them a thing, they've always done it that way. At the opposite extreme, there are 10% who will never learn how to do it because they are non-participants. They just don't want to learn it. You can get them to read all the books, but they're still not going to do it well. The good news is that most of us, are part of the 80% in the middle. We are neither naturals nor non-participants, but we can learn new skills if properly guided. What is not teachable is another key requirement of trusted advisors and coaches, that he or she is viewed as honorable, honest, trustworthy, consistent, dependable, and has an interest in others. Those are not behavioral descriptors, but character descriptors. A worldwide study that I conducted showed that the most successful managers were notable less for their beliefs and actions than for their underlying character. I'll tell you more about that in the next episode of this podcast series. Here's the next question for you. Can you help people to visualize and articulate their dreams? To influence people, you must make them want to do something. Well, how's this achieved? Dale Carnegie gave us the secret when he wrote, "He or she who can get people to dream can conquer the world." A large part of getting people to show energy is to get them to fervently desire something, the new dream. You can't just say, "Thou shalt be energized." That doesn't work very well. Much more powerful is to help create the tantalizing dream. How would you like to have this kind of work, these kind of clients, that kind of reputation? Let's talk about where you want to be 3 years from now. In what way could your work life be better? What would you like to have that you don't have now? The response you're looking for is, "Wow, is any of that possible?" And you can say, "Well, work with me and I can get you real close." The job is to get the other person to choose a goal. We've talked about that. Because, of course, the minute they choose a goal, you get what we've called in a previous episode, the nagging rights. You can discuss with each of the people in your group what they want to achieve with their careers and help them determine for themselves the first logical steps. And you can then come back a month later and say, "By the way, how's that article going that you said you were going to write?" You need to understand each of your people in such a way that you help each one develop an individualized stretch goal, custom tailored, that they will accept as exciting and challenging. They must believe that they do it for themselves because it is in their best interest, not for the firm and not for the group. If you can't pull that off, you'll never be effective as a practice leader. Whether or not someone is willing to accept your coaching depends on whether or not you have a relationship with that person. If you do, they'll accept your input or at least listen. If there's no prior relationship, if it's just a transaction, they'll pretend to listen, but they'll resist all the way. I think relationships between human beings follow similar principles, whether we're talking about business life or personal life. Ask yourself, what are the actions, secrets, and rules of romance in your personal life that build strong, deep, long-lasting relationships? In short, what do you do to build a great relationship? Here are a few of the responses I got from a group of professionals when I posed these questions. Number one, you need to be available as a sounding board to your romantic partner. You don't need to be critical. Listen before you react. Number two, work really hard at listening and understanding before you say anything. Number three, do the unexpected occasionally. Don't take each other for granted. Number four, discuss your common values and find out what you have in common. Number five, communicate honestly, openly, and frequently. Number six, spend time with each other when there's no agenda, just because you want to talk to each other and catch up. Number seven, show your appreciation regularly, but not in a formulaic way. Find ways to have fun together. Don't let problems fester. Catch them and discuss them early. Would you agree that these principles of great relationship building in personal life have their counterparts in work life? What other rules of relationship building with friends, romantic partners, and family members would you identify? Do you apply those same principles at work? Are you as considerate, supportive, sensitive to feelings, understanding, and loyal to those you lead as to those in your personal life? These questions are not about what you should do in any moral sense. The point is simply that you will have greater influence on other people to the extent that they believe you are in a relationship. Here are four quick rules of romance. Show interest, work at understanding me, spend time with me when there's nothing to get done, and give of yourself. In romance, you show interest by asking questions, listening, and getting the other person to do the talking. In other words, you can't initiate a relationship if you go in there with your agenda too explicitly showing. The essence of romancing another person is getting him or her to talk about what they want to talk about. It's not that you're not going to get to your agenda, but rather it's an issue of timing. The essence of building a new relationship is that you need to understand this other human being as fast as you can so that you can subsequently figure out how to customize your language and change your behavior to influence that particular person. You even need to take them out for drinks, have a cup of coffee, and talk to them about their personal lives. That's what we heard somebody say earlier in this podcast. It turns out that it matters. You gotta do it. You cannot possibly build a managerial relationship if they think you are not interested in them as people. You've got to ask them about their business and their lives and then shut up. Just listen. The more you can learn about people, about what they like and don't like, what they respond to and don't respond to, then the more you will be able to figure out the right things to say to have influence to that person. Try to find your common ground. I'm not saying you never have your personal agenda. I'm trying to say you keep it to yourself until you've done the things that win you the permission to coach. If you want to earn somebody's trust and confidence in a romantic relationship, you do a little something to test the waters. You make a gesture of goodwill. But you can't get what you want from the other person if you haven't first given to them. Which leads us back to the conclusion, before you can get somebody else to change his or her behavior, you have to ask yourself how you can actually help them. It must not have the appearance of a barter deal. I'll do this for you if you do that for me. That's too crass and it doesn't work. It can't be, I'll help you now and I want this right away. You build relationships by being seen to be willing to invest in the relationship. Another question you must ask to see if you have the stuff managers are made of, do people feel comfortable admitting their flaws to you? You cannot be a good coach if people don't feel comfortable admitting their weaknesses in front of you. A good test of coaching is, are they coming to you or do you always have to go to them? They'll only come to you if you're even-tempered, you're even-keeled, you're there to help, and they can confess weaknesses to you. Most of coaching is about emotions. If you can make somebody want to do something, you've done maybe 9/10 of your job. Showing them how to do it is the easy part. The main job is helping them overcome fears and concerns. If they say, I'm worried about this, it doesn't help to simply say, don't worry about that. You've got to help people deal with their worries and their fears. Management, it turns out, has nothing to do with intellect, nothing to do with IQ, nothing to do with rationality, nothing to do with smarts. Management is entirely about psychology, interpersonal skill, politics, and emotions. It's a tough job, and most of us, including me, are not really suited for the role. This has been The Management Strain, the sixth episode in my 15-part series, Managing Professionals: Attitudes, Skills, Behaviors. In future episodes, I'll look at how to deal with underperformers and disruptive people, and how to forge teams out of autonomous professionals. If you'd like more information or access to other podcasts in this series, or the previous series, Marketing Professional Services, go to my website, davidmaester.com. This podcast series is now available for purchase, both as a single episode and as part of a DVD set, from my website, davidmaester.com/store, STORE. I'm also pleased to announce that my forthcoming book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker, is available for pre-order from this same location.